I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about crime and public safety. Indianapolis's homicide rate has exploded in 2014. We've recorded more than 50 murders this year so far, a pace that, on a per capita basis, puts the Circle City well ahead of Chicago. We'll talk about what causes there might be for this acceleration of killing and whether other types of crime are showing similar growth. And we'll talk about what we might be able to do about it. My guest today will be Troy Riggs, Indianapolis Public Safety Director. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about public safety in Indianapolis today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Well, I have one guest today. One is more than enough. We have with us Indianapolis Public Safety Director Troy Riggs. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
It is good to have you here. Probably we'll get to, and we alluded in the intro to the fact that there are some challenges confronting the city right now, but I think the last time you were on this program, you were relatively new to the job.
That is correct. I've been here since October 2012, so about a year and a half. Been a busy year and a half.
What have been how's that first year and a half been? What are some of the lessons learned? What parts have been easier than you thought? What parts have been harder?
Well, I guess the even though I thought we had a tremendous workforce, and people have to realize we have 3,200 employees within the Department of Public Safety. We comprise 85% of the entire city general fund. And I knew we had a good workforce, but I was surprised even arriving and had been working with Indianapolis in the past to see the level of dedication and commitment and expertise that we have within the city. We're very fortunate to have employees like that. Like I said, I held them in high regard, but after meeting with them and seeing what they do each and every day, I even have more respect for them, and they've been the catalyst for change. A lot of things that we have accomplished only because our workforce and the community has been involved. Some of the things a little bit harder than I thought. It was a little bit harder to get data in a city this size than I thought it would be. That's something I was brought here to do, was to improve, but I was a little alarmed by the lack of data, and I know the mayor had been really pushing for more data and data analysis. We're working very hard to do that. We've invested $15 million. The mayor had already invested that before I arrived. We will see the benefits of that at the end of this year, early next year. But just really the lack of data and being able to make firm decisions based on data, as I'd like to do in using business practices, that has been disappointing, but it's something that we're working through.
What sort of data are we talking about that's missing, and how would it be useful?
In particular, crime data. When I arrived, the police department had struggled for years to report crime data in a timely way. Now, there's some issues with crime data nationally anyway. Crime is underreported 30 to 50% nationally. We know that. It's a recent study by the Police Foundation out of Washington, D.C. That's for a myriad of reasons. But still, it gives you a kind of a historical look. It gives you some hot spots you need to look at. Chief Hyde made it a priority once I arrived. We talked about it in depth. We're up to speed, but still, being up to speed means we're still about a month behind in crime data. That's as good as we can accomplish with the system we have now that's a little antiquated. However, with the mayor investing $15 million in the new system, crime data will be available to citizens within hours, not just police officers, the citizens. They will be able to set at their computer, their smartphone, see crime within hours. The biggest lag that we will have in crime data would be as long as 8 hours, and that's it. Most crime would be available within 1 to 2 hours. That will occur later this year. But the other thing that we need to talk about, John, is if we're going to use data in making decisions, mm-hmm. we need to be the first city in the nation to really look at all data. And what I mean by that is we want to begin with police data, but we also want to look at health data, social services, what are available in the communities, where are the schools in the communities, what are those natural boundaries. Make sure we have all that data, put it into one system so that the mayor of our city and future mayors can walk into one room, see all government operation and all the needs in the city in one place, that data compiled. That's what we've been working on fast and furious for the last year and a half. We are making tremendous progress, but anytime you institute a $15 million change in data collection, there's going to be some issues. We've had a few hiccups, but it's moving forward, and citizens will really start seeing the benefit of that later this summer, early fall, and really great deal of changes in 2015.
Two questions. I mean, what inhibited the collection and distribution of that kind of data, that kind of information in the past? What was the block? Was it just the technology wasn't there, or that the city refused to invest in it?
No, the city's always invested heavily in public safety, and it's not the city's refusal. A lot of it's technology. What used to take me doing data-driven policing, and I had been involved in data-driven policing 15 years ago, but what used to take me a day and a half, when this system's up and running, is going to take an officer less than 5 minutes. That's the power of technology. And then when you look at the time to invest in the new technologies coming out, it kind of occurred about the same time that we had the downturn in the economy, and departments had to make a tough decision about data. They had to make tough decisions about civilian employees who put the data together. And a lot of those civilian employees were let go because of police officer needs and making sure we have adequate staffing. That occurred throughout this nation. Fortunately, in Indianapolis, we did not have to lay off any police officers or civilian employees through attrition, people leaving, and slots not being filed or filled. They were able to balance that budget. And I think as a result, not only Indianapolis, but other cities lag behind in technology where we need to be. But I will say this, I've worked for basically three different governments, consulted others, worked with other governments. We're not behind other cities. Our goal is to be world class, and that's what we're trying to accomplish here with our new $15 million investment and the training that we're doing with our employees.
We are talking about crime and public safety here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. You said that citizens would begin to see the impact starting at the end of this summer and through the beginning of next year. In what ways will they see the impact other than, kind of the, I feel a little more involved now because I can look this up on my computer? And in practical ways, how will this make a difference?
Well, as far as technology, when they're worried about a crime spree or they see some a police car down the street from them, right now they really have nowhere to turn. They don't want to call the non-emergency number or the emergency. They don't want to bother the police with that, but they really are wondering what occurred, and word of mouth spreads. And a lot of times that's not very accurate. For the first time in the history of this city, they will be able to go to one website and actually see what crime has been reported. They will actually be able to see what dispatch runs police officers have been on, emergency runs that are all of our Department of Public Safety. And then as that progresses, they'll be able to get online and be able to see the local social service agency that may be able to help one of their family members with a heroin issue or somebody nearby in domestic violence. Those are the things we want to provide citizens so that they can have a resource and then a direct conduit to work with public safety and with our public safety officials to make sure that their communities are a place where we reduce crime, the fear of crime, enhance the quality of life for those residents.
Speaking of, the issue that has gotten the most attention in the city, obviously, is the homicide rate.
Yes.
This year. There are so many ways we can start with that subject. We probably start with an agreement that there have been too many of them.
There are way too many.
Way too many of them. What accounts for that? I mean, in terms of someone who is working with, what is producing this kind of almost unprecedented wave?
A lot of social issues we're dealing with. We're dealing with, and not any of them lead to crime, but you put those together and they do. For instance, I grew up in a very poor area of Louisville, Kentucky. Many of my friends, same situation. Many individuals in that community went on to very productive lives. So it wasn't because we were poor that led us to crime. If there's a fallacy to think that because people are poor, they're going to turn to crime, that has never been the case in American history. Actually, the reverse has been the case. In times of economic boom is when we've seen the greatest increase in crime. So, but when you put poverty with lack of education, with single head of households, and you put that together, then that becomes the recipe for crime in many areas. We're seeing a lot of those social issues. We're seeing young people that we talk to in our community conversations that are telling us they feel like they have no one that loves them, no one that cares for them, no one that wants to help them get ahead in life. That is a terrible outlook to have. That's not the outlook I had when I was growing up. I may have been in a poor community, not had much, and people living in a poverty rate all around, but I never thought I couldn't do better in this country. That bothers me. It worries me. But there's other issues. Your police department's working very hard and working smarter than ever, targeting hotspots. Chief Hite's done an exceptional job there. But here's some troubling statistics we know of. In 2012, when I arrived, homicide rate was under 100. However, the aggravated assault numbers were way up, substantially up. Shootings were up substantially. The only difference between an aggravated assault and a homicide is where the bullet lands. If the bullet lands in a heart and someone dies, it's a homicide. If it lands in their arm, it ends up being an aggravated assault. But the intent, John, was always the same, was to take a human life. So we have to look at the totality of that. And I was alarmed coming in. And we put together a violent crime reduction team. Chief Hite put it together, looked at everything from truancy to reentry and trying to deal with the issues that we had to deal with. As a result of that, we started putting in plans. And believe it or not, last year when we had 125 homicides, shootings, fatal and non-fatal, in the city of Indianapolis actually dropped by 5%. First time I've ever seen that happen, where homicides are up. One of the reasons we think that occurred was a lot of it's more personal, a lot of it's family issues, a lot of it's drug-related, but a lot of it's behind closed doors. About 42-45% of all homicides now occur behind closed doors in the city. And I'll leave you with this one statistic that's sobering, too. In 2012, all suspects and victims of homicides, when you look at those numbers and you look at both and put them together, 70% of suspects and victims had some type of criminal past in regards to crimes against persons. In 2013, that jumped to 75%. This year, that number has jumped to 85%. We are seeing far too often people that are very violent, that are getting charged with crimes by the police department, going away to jail for only a couple years, coming right back out and committing homicides. We've got to do a better job.
We are talking about crime and public safety with Indianapolis Public Safety Director Troy Riggs. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I just had a question concerning revolving around the Simeon Adams case, the juvenile that shot the Trapezzano a few weeks back.
Yes, sir.
And specifically the fact that he had two gun possession charges in recent history, and I believe both of those were charged as misdemeanors, and that he wasn't locked up. I know the sort of scenario with his probation officer having not called on him to be held in custody, but more specifically to the fact that those gun possession charges were limited to misdemeanors and that he wasn't immediately locked up on the second one. And I'm just kind of concerned, like, and my question is, what is the parameters that the prosecutor's office operates within that allowed that to happen?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Tom.
And thank you. And you bring up something that's very much a concern for us in public safety, and especially the police department. Chief Hite has talked about this numerous times, is that too often someone commits a violent crime or a crime with a gun, and they're not dealt with appropriately. Juveniles are completely different. There's a lot of talk going on the state house level now, and how do we revamp some of our old juvenile codes, because the juveniles today are much more violent in some respects, and we have to be able to deal with them more effectively. But while some people say, well, this happened because it was a juvenile, let's remember, someone still lost their life. We need to address those on the state house. That is outside of our world within the Department of Public Safety, but we want to influence that. But you may be surprised that not only is that an issue in the juvenile side, it also is an issue on the adult side. The individual that shot 9 people at Black Expo before I arrived, that individual got sentenced to 8 years. I go back to, once again, the intent was always for someone to lose a life that night, but no one lost their life, so he was sentenced to only 8 years, not even a year per victim. He was out in 2 years and a half causing issues within our community. We have to address those type of issues moving forward, and that's going to take the legislature and the local courts to do so.
We are talking about crime and public safety here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. As I said, we're talking about crime and public safety in Indianapolis. Our guest is Indianapolis Public Safety Director Troy Riggs. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about public safety in Indianapolis with Indianapolis Public Safety Director Troy Riggs. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881, or you can do what a listener named Ann did and send us an email at nolimitswfyi. She says, the bottom line, it would seem, is the issue in public safety. At what point will officials have the courage to stand up and insist on raising taxes to properly fund public safety in the city?
Well, and that is a debate that goes on with our elected officials all the time. But we have to realize we're talking about 85% of the entire budget is devoted to public safety. If you add the court system, the prosecutor's office, and the sheriff's department, we're up to 92%. Everything else government does in this city is on 8% of the budget. 92%. One of the issues that we deal with a lot is if we add police officers or firefighters, which we are, and we've been real good with our budgets and finding attrition and saving money to hire additional officers and get us above the retirements for the first time in many years. Even with that, you have to look at if we raise our taxes to hire additional officers, that makes us economically it hurts us because people will move to other counties where they have less of a tax structure. So it's a very complex issue. Now, I will say this. We have a plan to hire additional officers that we have found money within our police department. The council and the mayor are working to try to hire even additional and looking at some additional taxes that hopefully will not hurt our competitive nature within Indianapolis. But I will tell you this. We have to make sure we understand that whether we get 100 more officers, 200 officers, or 500 more officers, 42% of our homicides are behind closed doors. Adding officers does not mean we'll reduce homicides. Dealing with the social issues that have led to homicides is long-term crime prevention. Short-term crime prevention, more officers, more money, that helps. But long-term crime prevention is when the community gets involved in the crime issue, steps up and helps these social service agencies, and we work together in unison to make our city safer.
Well, we've gotten a tweet from a listener named Joshua that's right on point here. And if you want to reach out to us via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Joshua's question is, Mr. Riggs, what in your view are some of the best ways for faith organizations to be involved in addressing city needs?
That is a great question, and I'll have to say that in my tenure as a public safety official for years, I have been disappointed by the lack of involvement by some churches. Most of the time they say they don't want to get involved with government. We're not asking you to get involved in government, but we're asking you to get involved with a young person's life. If you're not sure what social service agencies are out there that you can trust, because there have been some that have stolen money, I understand that. There is a large group of social service agencies, community-based programs, that we work with constantly. We know that they have a good track record, that they have spent money wisely. We will share that with you. All anyone has to do is send us an email at dps@indy.gov, and I will tell you this. Also, I would love to hear from local churches and houses of faith and inviting me or the chief or somebody from our staff out to just share information, the complexities of what we're doing. But the biggest thing that I've seen churches do is to take a geographical area of our city, whether it's around their church or in a poor section of town, and say, we're going to own this area. And what I mean by that is, if somebody needs to be clothed, we're going to clothe them. If someone needs to be fed, we're going to feed them. If someone needs tutoring, we're going to tutor them. And police department, if someone dies in this area from a homicide, we want to be there to support the family. That's how churches can get involved. We're very good in the Department of Public Safety of responding, holding people accountable, arresting people, putting them in jail, convicting them. We're good at that. Mm-hmm. We've done a very good job. You look at our clearance rates. What we're not good at is holding someone's hand, mentoring them, and helping them rebuild their lives. We can't do that within government, not within Department of Public Safety, but churches can, and we need their help. And the success, quite frankly, of our crime prevention efforts in the future is good men and women getting involved and helping young people change their attitudes, helping individuals that are coming out of prison with reentering, getting good jobs. You know, we have 5,000 to 7,000 people reentering Marion County every year after being in prison. That's an astounding number. They need help.
That's a small town all by itself.
It is, and you extrapolate that over 10 or 15 years.
And then it's not a small town anymore.
Exactly.
It's bigger. We are talking about crime and public safety here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question about the availability of guns, and if the city has ever pursued any kind of, taxation or anything for the liability that the guns are costing the taxpayer.
No, what we have been doing, and the mayor has been at the forefront, is going to the legislature and asking for mandatory minimum sentencing, which gets the attention of criminals. Mandatory minimum sentencing, much like the federal government has, that says if you use a weapon in a crime, in the commission of a crime, in the commission of a violent act, whether you fire it or you use it to intimidate someone, you will be held to a higher standard. And as a result, you would get, the mayor was wanting to get 20, 25 years mandatory minimum sentencing. That did not go through. Now, it did go through that they may give an additional 20 years, but it does not say shall. And what happens in those cases is when you go to prison, for instance, we had an individual that was sentenced to 16 years in prison for a violent crime with a weapon. And as a result of that 16 years, he was out in 783 days, and he was the individual that was the leader of the group that did the home invasion on the north side. So we've been focusing our attention on being tough on individuals that use weapons, to make sure that they are being held accountable for their actions. We have not looked at any additional taxes or anything along those ways regarding weapons. We know a great deal of people in Indiana and Indianapolis own weapons. They do so responsibly. I think the deterrent, though, is making sure that people get mandatory minimum sentences if they use it in a crime.
That issue, though, that I think Kathy is alluding to, obviously, that's been a big debate here in the city with the arrival of the National Rifle Association convention. We had obviously a show on this subject just a few days ago, and there's been debates going on all over the city about the availability of guns. Does that exacerbate the problem, the fact that there are just so many guns? I mean, most of the estimates now say that there are more than 400 million of them floating around in private hands in the country right now, more than one gun per person in the country or more than two per adult.
That is a problem. But the balance is we have a Second Amendment, and I don't want to get into a Second Amendment debate.
Yeah.
And because I feel like when we get into a Second Amendment debate,
everything else falls off.
Everything else falls apart. So I'm very careful not to get into that debate. But I am talking about mandatory minimum sentencing, and we have to be honest. If you purchase a weapon and you own a weapon, that is a great responsibility. I believe you should know how to, you should be trained with that weapon, properly know how to use that weapon. And then also you should be held accountable if that weapon ends up in the hands of a juvenile or someone in the commission of a crime.
So there should be some liability.
I think there should be huge liability, and there has not been liability to the level we need there to be in the past.
What changes? Not just in terms of gun laws, but, you know, you've talked about mandatory minimum sentences here. You've talked about, you know, really it sounds like would you be talking about criminal liability or civil liability or both in the event that you don't take care of your weapons and somebody gets hurt?
Because I think it could be both.
Could be both.
I think it should be both. I'm not saying now, remember, I'm not getting into Second Amendment debate, but if I drive my car down the street 120 miles an hour and I hit someone, I'm liable on the criminal side and I'm liable on the civil side. It should be the same with a weapon. If your weapon's stolen, that's one thing, but if you've left your weapon out and your child's playing with a weapon or takes it out and robs someone, you should be held accountable for that because you're accountable for the actions of your young people.
We are talking about crime and public safety here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. What other changes, common sense changes like that, in the way we address crime would make a difference?
Well, the gun debate. Mm-hmm. Is something that people talk about all the time, but we cannot overlook the impact. I mean, usually in excess of 80, sometimes 90% of homicides are because of a weapon. Mm-hmm. Maybe we need to start spending more time trying to trace those weapons. And I know Chief Hyde is working on that. And a lot of people say, well, the federal government will do that. Well, the federal government can only handle a handful of cases. We're talking about, 400 shootings per year, give or take. We need to do a better job, quite frankly, and we're trying to get there. But some other things that are just simple measures that could help substantially is for us not to be so apathetic. We've been apathetic in this nation for years about crime in general. We don't report crime. We think we can't report crime because it's too small and it'll take time away from police officer doing real police work. Well, I can tell you that a lot of the cases we've solved on something as simple as breaking into a car leads into a gang issue that leads to something bigger. We need to know about all crime. We're going to try to be more robust in our ways of gathering that crime data, making sure that people can report online. Those are goals for the future. This new system is going to look like crime is going up because we're doing a better job of capturing that crime. But if we're going to be data-driven, something as simple as people reporting all crime will help us tremendously. The other thing that will help is just get involved in your community. If you can help one young person get a high school diploma, go to college, and you can break that cycle in the family of not being educated and taking menial jobs, then you have broken a cycle for a whole generation and for the future of that family. It's about caring for one another, and we have to stop being apathetic when we hear of schools that are failing, kids that are going hungry. We need to roll up our sleeves and get involved as a community. It's going to take that type of effort to ensure that we don't have the issues that some other cities are having. And we're seeing some troubling signs. Last year at the 4th of July celebration, we had a group of kids that confronted the police department. Police department had to use some mace to disperse them. They regrouped and came back to take on the police department again. First time we'd seen that in Indianapolis. Recently with the young people downtown after the 16-year-old had been charged with the murder of the young expectant father, they challenged the media and challenged the public. People are starting to see publicly what we deal with as a police department, public safety, each and every day. These are social issues that aren't going to go away unless good people get involved in their community.
We are talking about crime and public safety here on No Limits. Please join the conversation by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Will, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just calling just to say that, the parental accountability for a lot of the minors should be something that people should consider. A lot of the kids commit these crimes because there's no parenting or no adult involved or knowing what their kids are doing or what's going on. And that's something that, the gentleman mentioned, if you buy a gun and the child commits a crime with that gun, there should be some sort of accountability for that.
And I agree. And I will tell you what makes that even more difficult, though, is if we start enacting this and we work, is that what do you do with a single mother that's working hard, trying to make ends meet, and their young person does something wrong, but she's doing all the right things. She's trying to help out. There's got to be, we can't just be so dogmatic that we're going to punish everyone. And there is, quite frankly, there's a large segment of our population of young people that are causing issues that have no one.
Is that, I realize we want to stay away from the Second Amendment because that's kind of a, a third rail, or at least
right.
deal with it carefully. But the other one is sort of that notion of responsibility for child rearing. I mean, that in some ways it sounds like what you're arguing here is the whole it takes a village to raise a child, that it has to be a community responsibility and not just a parent responsibility.
If a parent refuses to raise his or her child, I think it's incumbent upon our community to do that, much like families have been doing for years, where you have a child that's in a terrible situation. Maybe the father's an alcoholic or the mother, and you're trying to figure out, and the family takes that child in. We need churches and people to step up. Now, that doesn't mean that we still don't hold those individuals that are absent parents responsible. Mm-hmm. We should as a society, especially when we're having to take care of their children. But I was really struck by something that President Obama said when I was at the White House for his announcement on my brother's keeper, where he's talking about individuals, much like we're talking about throughout mm-hmm. this nation, in cities that have far more issues than we have. And he was challenging a lot of individuals. And remember, in this group, you had everyone from Bill O'Reilly to Reverend Sharpton there in support. But his statement that I thought was profound, he said, nothing changes a young person's life like a father who's been absent that's now involved in his life or her life. If the father is not going to be present, then it's our responsibility as adults in this nation to step up and to help these young people. And I agree with him there. It's our future. It's our future.
Yeah, we've gotten a tweet that's pretty much on that subject, too, about talking about how the breakdown of family models affects crime. And it sounds like you're saying that's a large portion of the problem.
Absolutely. And I think it says a lot about our city that we recognize that. We recognize the work police are doing, but we also recognize there's other issues at play.
We are talking about crime and public safety here on No Limits with Public Safety Director Troy Riggs. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I was listening to the Public Safety Director. My neighborhood has had waves of burglaries and burglaries and burglaries, and it seems as though the officers seem to not take that sort of thing seriously. While they're concentrating on murders, et cetera, and they should, when you have waves of burglaries where people are breaking into homes on a regular basis, and you talk to the officers or you call in about them, it seems as though you're basically treated as though they're not important. We're just waiting for somebody in our neighborhood to get hurt.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mike. We'll try to get you an answer.
I will say this. If you think you were treated poorly or it wasn't taken seriously, if you would not mind, send me an email, dps@nd.gov. I will get that email. We will look into it and get back to you. But I will tell you this, that is unacceptable. We need to make sure that every crime is treated as it is a crime. And as we talk about people not being apathetic about educational attainment and homicides, we as public safety officials can never be apathetic about responding to the community and meeting your needs as a resident. So please send me that information.
You do hear that argument fairly frequently, and let's face it, I mean, it's not like the resources are endless here. If you're on a pace to have 150 homicides in this city, one would figure that would preoccupy a lot of your attention.
That is true, and I'll say sometimes, and let me say this, our police officers do an extraordinary job every day. And sometimes what we find out when someone gives us that information is that we learn that not only were they dealing with these burglaries, but they had runs stacked, which means they had two or three runs in the queue that they had to make, and then an emergency comes out. So they're trying to clear so they can go give backup to an officer. If that's the case, then we talk to them about how to respond appropriately to those. And what we have found out is when we do some additional training and explain to citizens, they understand that. Sometimes we come back. Sometimes it's over the phone. We just need to be better in our response and our customer service.
We are talking about crime and public safety in Indianapolis. My guest is Indianapolis Public Safety Director Troy Riggs. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about public safety in Indianapolis, and my guest is Indianapolis Public Safety Director Troy Riggs. We've got an email question from a listener named Patrick. And if you'd like to connect with us via email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. While it is admirable that the Director of Public Safety is acknowledging that there are socioeconomic factors that drastically affect not just the homicide rate, but the overall crime rates in Indianapolis, I detect that he has ignored two extremely important issues/factors. The Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department not only has an image problem, thanks to several high-profile incidents involving public intoxication while on duty, abuse of power, and even a murder of another officer and estranged wife, but unlike the Chicago Police Department, there doesn't seem to be a real public initiative to bring law enforcement and peacekeeping down to the community level. In short, the IMPD needs to not only steer more funds toward hiring new sworn officers, but as a law enforcement agency, they need to re-earn the trust of the communities they work in, as well as excise any officer that does not engage in abuse of power or dereliction of duty. So why has there not been any sort of public effort to engage in either of those practices?
Well, excellent comments. And I will have to say that back in January, I gave a speech regarding all the Department of Public Safety and said we're going to work hard to earn your respect as a department. And we have shared this information publicly. I will admit that it hasn't gotten out as much as I would like it as far as newscasts, but let me explain what we have been doing. Does the IMPD have an image problem? I think anyone within IMPD, when I arrived, would say yes, and they wanted to improve that, and I agree. There has been an image problem, but let me explain some of the things we have done to try to not just deal with the image problem. This is not PR for us. This is about how do we make sure that we have a culture of excellence where people are held accountable. First thing that I did when I arrived was I looked at the disciplinary process for the police department, and I found it to be inadequate. We made sure that we put a team together to look at the best practices nationally on how to investigate things like rudeness complaints, speeding complaints, just the interaction that you have. I found out that officers were not pleased with it. Some of these investigations were taking 2 years. I also found out that our citizen police complaint office was not involved in the day-to-day activities of Department of Public Safety. All that's been changed. We put the team together to review. We brought somebody outside the Department of Public Safety to look at our process. We have adopted a brand-new process for internal affairs complaints for the police department. We did this within the first year. All of our officers have been updated. We purchased a program called Internal Affairs Pro. That means that complaints are treated respectfully, but they're also timely, that you can look now and find out what complaints are being filed, how they're being investigated. And there are severe penalties for someone that does not report a complaint that has been given to a supervisor. All that is in place now, and I can tell you that complaints on police officers as a result of this new discipline, the new discipline that the chief has been handing out, more severe than has happened in the recent history of IMPD. I'm pleased to report we have fewer complaints on officers now than at any time since the merger of Metro into the Metro Police Department. And I'll also say that our rank and file have led the charge in this. Disciplinary processes now, some of them were languishing for 2 years, are now down to 45 days is the most we have. It's a process that's firm and it's fair, and the chief is probably, I believe the chief has terminated or removed more people than any previous chief. Now, how do we investigate criminal allegations? That process is being overhauled now. We're working closely with the district prosecutor or the county prosecutor, Mr. Curry's office. We'll continue to move forward. And this year, we are going to train 600 of our first-line supervisors, which means all of our police officers, sergeants, and lieutenants will be there on how to manage people, how to lead people, and how to hold people accountable. That's a tremendous amount of work in the first year, and I certainly appreciate his call. And I think you may be surprised to realize that not only do I agree with parts of that, but police officers do as well, because they brought it to my attention when I arrived.
We are talking about crime and public safety here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Leslie, welcome to the program. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Leslie.
Oh, I'm sorry. I haven't done this before.
What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm a former social worker, and I'm well aware that individual, family, community, there's so many factors that can, and employment opportunities and lack thereof feed into this problem of crime. However, it's my understanding that there's a tremendous amount of pressure from international drug cartels to sell drugs. And unfortunately, many people are interested in buying them, but that this really hits, this really can contribute to crime on a local level. And I never seem to see any references to that in the newspaper. I'm aware that this is probably something the FBI handles and not, you know, a local police department, but still, I'd be very interested in hearing any comments that he could make about this.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie. I will tell you that just yesterday we received a briefing on drug cartels and their movement of heroin throughout the United States. Where we get most of our heroin is through Mexico. A lot of it goes to Chicago first, comes down 65 into the city. The best way to stop drug use is to curb America's voracious appetite for drugs. It is a business that is booming. Our legislature, our leaders have done a good job of reducing the availability of prescription-type drugs, but as a result, more people are turning to heroin now. We are seeing a heroin epidemic sweep this nation. We are just at the beginning stages here in Indianapolis, and we have to realize we lost about 110 people that we know of to heroin overdoses last year in this city. That number is going to be way up. Our EMS is administering or doing a lot of care for individuals that are overdosing on heroin. We're seeing more and more seizures as a result. But, yes, international cartels play a big role in that. Do they have a home base in Indianapolis? Not at this time. It's the DEA that works very closely with us on these issues, and we have that in mind. We're watching that. But heroin is so cheap nationally right now. There's so much of it, and it's so pure and so cheap they don't cut it any longer, which is causing more people to die as a result of using, because it's more of a pure heroin. But a hit of heroin right now nationally is averaging somewhere between $6 and $10. That's how inexpensive it is, and that's how much is out there on our streets.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Michael, and I'm going to abridge it in the interest of getting still more listeners' questions asked and answered. It says it's his understanding that in New York City, they were able to lower the overall crime rates, including the violent ones, by attacking more aggressively the lesser crimes, that they saw that there was a progression.
Right.
Is that valid? Is that part of the strategy here in Indianapolis?
That is valid. And that's where I was talking about the data and putting data together and dealing with not only crime issues but quality of life issues and making sure that we have that. So, yes, he is absolutely right. We are focused on that. The other thing they did is they were very tactical, and they used some aggressive police tactics as well. And we have done that as well here in Indianapolis. And even though we're talking about this high homicide rate, let's remember in 2013, overall shootings were down, violent crime was down, and property crime was down. It was homicide was the only area that was up. And that surprises people sometime. And actually, the amount of violence in the community was down. So there's some good news there. But when you have 125 people die, that's troublesome, especially when you realize how many of them have just been released from prison. But you have 125 people that died, 110 people died of heroin overdoses, and something we don't really talk about a lot, but we should because it kind of shows what's going on socially. We had 168 people take their own lives last year in our city, and 100 others that we know of tried and failed. There are a lot of issues that we're dealing with as a community.
We've gotten another email question from a listener named Mari. Says, I am new to Indy and have noticed there are many police officers driving around or sitting in their cars. I say get out of your cars and walk areas, get to know members of the community, and that will help reduce the crime.
And I, you know what, I agree 100%, and that's one of the reasons that when we arrived, we worked very hard at repurposing officers. And what I mean by repurposing, putting officers on the street so we have more officers available to get out of their cars, meet the community that they serve, and make sure, and we're moving to that direction. Now, I will tell you this, a lot of times our officers will go to a certain area that's close or in the middle point of their district to respond quickly to scenes, and they'll do paperwork while they're sitting in that car. But I know more and more officers are able to get out and spend time, especially in some of these hotspot areas where we've had crime issues, quality of life issues. They're actually taking a roll call and having roll call so they can work and interact with the community. You'll see more of that in the future.
And then we've gotten a tweet from a listener that says, to cultivate a culture of excellence by getting rid of bad officers and being more selective with new recruits. Has that been part of the equation, too, is trying to elevate the entrance requirements?
It is. And let me say this. I think we run the risk because of a couple of high-profile cases of casting dispersions on an entire group of police officers. I can tell you the handful of events that have occurred, and they have been horrific events. I will not take anything away from those. That's not indicative of the men and women I see every day that's trying to do a good job. And Chief Hyde is doing an outstanding job of holding officers accountable. He's working very hard to do that, even terminating people at time and civilian employees as well. But that is a key. And then as we go about hiring new officers over the next few years, it looks like we're going to hire 80 this year. We're making sure we get a candidate that not only understands what it is to be an officer, but understands what it is to work with the community and be a good community member. But integrity is at the top of that list, and it is very difficult to find a human being willing to do the job of a police officer that has all the qualifications necessary to be an outstanding police officer.
And then we've got a question from a listener named Eric who says, how does a citizen go about reporting a police officer who is observed to be speeding? What information does a citizen need when making such a report? He says, I've also seen other infractions and would just like to know what the process is for reporting.
If you can get a license plate or a number off the car, or if you just give us the time of day and the location, we will certainly look into it. And that same email, we'll keep it simple. Anything you have, dps@indy.gov, you can send that, and we will look into it. And I can tell you that
I presume those are confidential.
Those are confidential, and what we'll do is all they have to is tell me is they have a complaint. We will get them in contact with the complaint office, and it'll all be taken care of.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Lisa who says, on April 23rd, my dear friend Kevin was bound and shot in an alley off 34th Street. A man has been charged, no details released. Was he a man with a prior record? How did he get the gun that took the life of this warm, generous, and incredibly funny man from so many who loved him? I do applaud the adding of more officers, and especially the work of Sergeant Jeff Wager, but how do we follow the developments in this case and others? I grew up in D.C. where the social and educational programs were prolific. Please bring the humanity of our victims, all of our victims, to light and help our youth rehab after prison. That's from a listener named Lisa. Lisa, my condolences on your loss.
Absolutely, and I agree with what she's saying, and I will say this, that there's a lot of details that can't be shared because we're working with the prosecutor's office on any of these homicides. They become known as the case moves on. You don't want to do anything to jeopardize. But I think her statements there should resonate with all of us, that when we think about victims of homicides, we forget that sometimes we look at numbers, but we forget this is a human being that has friends and families, and their lives have been changed forever.
Mm-hmm.
That's the devastating effect of homicides, and that's why I say we can't be apathetic about that. Even if someone that died has a long criminal history, they still have a family and friends, and it adversely affects those families.
Yeah, everyone's got a mother and a father.
And any time you talk to a victim's family of a homicide, it is amazing the pain and the suffering and the division that occurs within their own family as a result. It's a trying time, and we can never, never overlook that or become apathetic about that.
We are talking about crime and public safety here on No Limits. Connie, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
I have a question about graffiti. And the house that I have in the Brookside neighborhood, I had graffiti sprayed on the garage door last fall, as well as a neighbor. I reported it. A policeman came by, took a photograph. But the church that I attend also had some graffiti on a fence in the parking lot. I talked to a policeman about it. But it turns out that the policemen who really are on the gang task force are you don't have public access to them. You're talking to the officers that are on the street. They sometimes, they can usually tell you which gang it is by looking at the, well, you can usually tell by what they've sprayed. But, so I sanded the graffiti off last fall. This spring, I have graffiti again, and it is a different gang. And now that it's the individuals, now that there's some real responsibility on the part of the people who own the houses to get rid of the graffiti, it bothers me a little bit that we can't get any more information about which gang it is and what the territory is. And anyway, it's a, I just would like to hear Mr. Wood's response.
Certainly. We'll do that. We're getting close on time, so I'm going to throw it right to you. Thanks very much.
I will say this. She's right. We need to do a better job. Now, I apologize. We haven't in the past. We have a plan in place. We have a graffiti truck that will help with the abatement, help homeowners with the abatement. And part of that plan from the efficiency team we put together is to have a detective that's assigned with that, that looks at these, talks to residents, and keeps you better informed. That has not been done in the past. I'm very familiar with graffiti coming from my last position in South Texas, where graffiti was prolific, not just gang graffiti, but just individuals that want to tag areas. We need to do a better job. We have a plan to do that. We're working with the council's office as well, and there'll be great movement on that within the next few weeks.
Is that something that, you know, we started this program by talking about the new data collection efforts and all of that, that those kinds of things will be affected by being able to get a much better picture of what is the situation in regard to all kinds
of crimes
in the
city. It is, and it's a quality of life issue, as we've been talking about. We can't overlook any part of a community. If a community is struggling, let's look at all the issues it's struggling with, and let's deal with all of them holistically. And one of the issues that I think is a threat to the beauty of Indianapolis is a lot of the graffiti that we're seeing pop up, and if we don't get our arms around it now, it could become too much in the future. That's why we've invested in a vehicle, the sprayers and the things that we have to remove graffiti, and then also the police department giving a detective along. We're working with that now, working to make that a reality.
And I think we've come to the end of our time. We still have some listener questions out there, so I guess that's a reason for you to come back sometime. I hope you'll do that.
Absolutely, and dps@indy.gov, and I can answer questions online as well.
Great. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.